As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I'm Max Boltman, and with me as always is Prashant Iyer. We are recording here on Monday, March 22nd, during March Madness, arguably begrudgingly, but we're doing it because Prashant insisted, as someone who goes to the University of North Carolina, March Madness, just not really a priority there.
Yeah, I mean, the tournament's effectively over. They've already lost. They're out to Wisconsin. One of their best players is entering the transfer portal, so might as well go ahead and cancel the whole sport.
Well, some of us have our alma mater still in the tournament, and some of us need to wrap this one up by 7 p.m. for a big game that may or may not also have survivor pool implications for some of us, those of us, hypothetically.
Hypothetically speaking, of course.
But we've got some Red Wings stuff to get into before we do get to all of that. And the Red Wings' most recent series against the Dallas Stars happened entirely since the last time we talked to you. So you get a little bit of both worlds here. You get a 3-2 win in the Thursday game with a Robbie Fabry hat trick. That's the good. But of course, in that same game, you get a Jonathan Bernier injury. That's the very, very bad. Kamis Greiss comes in and gets the win in relief, but then you move into Saturday, and the Red Wings get completely dominated at basically every turn. They lose. I think the final score ends up at 3-0. It was a very, very uneventful game, but 3-0 pretty much tells you the story.
Yeah, I mean, that first game, you know, you're obviously very excited with the Fabry hat trick, but then, you know, if you're asking what's the worst possible injury that could happen to this Red Wings team, you know, some of you might vote for Dylan Larkin. It's really Jonathan Bernier. And man, that didn't look good. You know, it looked like he first got run over by his own player and then got maybe run over by one of the Stars players, took two knees to the back of the head. But then apparently it's a knee injury. And so return TBD, I think. You know, Blashill said it's day-to-day because they don't know how this type of injury heals. So, you know, that's absolutely the biggest disaster. And then you finish it up with the second game of that series and probably one of the Wings' worst hockey games of the year, offensively speaking. They generated absolutely nothing dangerous, didn't really test Anton Khudobin whatsoever, and he walks out of Detroit with a pretty easy 3-0 shutout, and the Stars are kind of turning their season around potentially on that one there. So, kind of a frustrating couple of games if you're a Wings fan.
Yeah, and the Bernier injury, obviously, I think is probably the big takeaway, which, you know, when someone gets a hat trick, that's kind of, it takes something pretty big to unseat it in the spotlight. But you're right, the Bernier injury qualifies. We don't know the timetable. We do know that it's a soft tissue injury, and that sounds like it maybe contributes to the unknown timetable just because of what you said. There's not like a fractured bone takes X long to heal. There's different elements to this. And so I think the Bernier injury is really the takeaway here, because you know, not only is he the goalie who's the source of all but, what, two or three of their wins in the last two seasons? I guess it's four now that Grace got one.
Which we should, by the way, talk about how Thomas Grace gets that win. You know, when Bernier leaves, the Wings are up 2-0, and because of the way the NHL does wins, once the Wings gave up two goals, the decision goes to Grace. So, yes, that makes four wins since October of, the start of the 2019-2020 season by a goaltender other than Jonathan Bernier. So, yeah, absolute disaster to lose him there.
Still only three in which Bernier doesn't play.
Yeah, three in which Bernier does not play.
So, from that standpoint, it's obviously massive. But as my athletic coworker Sean Gentile tweeted, oh no, are they not going to make the playoffs now? And I tweeted that it's a five-alarm fire. It has more layers than that. It has more than the fact that the Red Wings are going to have a harder time winning games. As you know, if you've been reading The Athletic, it is the trade deadline season, and Jonathan Bernier is going to be a focal point of that conversation. Not necessarily because he's going to be moved, but because he's a central figure in how the Red Wings approach this, whether they decide to move him and get a pick or a prospect, or whether they extend him for that first reason, that he's been a primary source of stability for them throughout the last 2 years, their best goalie for the last 2 years. That, to me, was shaping up to be maybe the most interesting decision they were going to have to make at this deadline, at least are the ones that we were going to find out about. I'm sure there's some interesting decisions that we never catch wind of, but that was going to be one of the more obvious ones that you could kind of really sink your teeth into and say, what should they do here? I think this introduces kind of a ton of uncertainty to that, certainly on the ability to move him.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's the local problems with the fact that Thomas Grice is dead last in the NHL in goals given up above expectation. But then now you kind of think about the trade ramifications. We are 20 days from the trade deadline with Jonathan Bernier potentially having an injury of unknown duration. And the market is almost ripe for him to be moved in the sense that you have a number of the teams that are, you know, towards the top of the NHL who have question marks in goal. Carolina, you know, as good as their tandem has been, Peter Mrazek has been out for a while with an injury. James Reimer's been up and down. And Alex Nedeljkovic is, again, a rookie goaltender coming in, relatively unproven. They may want to add something there. Toronto's really struggled. You know, Freddie Anderson has not looked great. Jack Campbell has looked pretty good. But, again, are they prepared to move forward with Jack Campbell being their starting goaltender and, you know, Freddie Anderson being the guy that's backing them up? I mean, we can continue to talk about Edmonton. Colorado's had issues with Pavel Francouz being out for a period of time. And, you know, they go out and they trade a 6th-round pick to Buffalo for Jonas Johansson, who I think there was a Buffalo beat writer, maybe John Vogel, who said, and I quote, Jonas Johansson is the worst goaltender I've ever watched in my entire time covering the Buffalo Sabres. So that's kind of the interesting dynamic to all of this is the market is really ripe for a guy like Bernier to go out and potentially have a bidding war for him. So injury really creates a bit of uncertainty here.
Yeah, it would have been interesting. I mean, I think the impression I've gotten is that, you know, you're still probably looking at mid-round picks for a lot of rentals. But the thing about a goalie is they arguably have the most potential to be that proverbial missing piece for a team to get someone to up that offer and come off of that kind of established price. You know, we looked at the trade comparables for some of the Red Wings top chips last week, and the one that came up for Bernier was Michael Neuwirth, and that's a 3rd-round pick, right? And so I think that's a fair expectation, but, you know, it changes in a second when a team decides you're the thing that they need to feel good about going into the playoffs, going on a cup run. And Colorado is a team that has every reason, like you mentioned, to do that. So, you know, I don't know that it's like a franchise altering. It's not a franchise altering situation here, but it does have a lot of kind of little interesting ripple effects as the Red Wings approach this trade deadline.
Yeah, I think exactly what you said, the fact that the goaltender is almost, you know, in when it comes to the NHL playoffs, you're kind of the player that can almost make or break a season or a playoff run. I mean, we've seen this happen time after time, whether it's, you know, Yaroslav Halak stopping the juggernaut Washington Capitals, or, you know, Red Wings fans have been on the end of Dwayne Roloson and a number of other goaltenders in the past. So, you know, those kinds of deals certainly are interesting to pay attention to if they happen. There haven't been a ton of those big name goalie deals where you know, a team is going out to swing for a goaltender right before the trade deadline to try and carry them forward. I think the one that really does come to mind was Dwayne Rolison in 06 going to the Oilers and then taking them all the way to game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals. I mean, that was a heck of a deal there. And so you never know what the market could be, even though, you know, right now I think most of us kind of think it could be that mid-round pick if the Wings choose to move Bernier. You get into a bidding war with those four teams I just mentioned there, you know, Colorado, Carolina, Edmonton, and Toronto, and potentially that price drives up. So we'll be really interesting to see how Bernier kind of shakes out over the next 20 days here.
And of course, there's the option of just extending him. Now, I think with the expansion draft considerations, there's a good argument to waiting to do that until after the expansion draft to make any kind of re-signing there, which at that point, it's not a big deal if you trade someone if you're not planning to sign them until effectively unrestricted free agency starts anyway. But I could also see someone making the case, hey, the way Thomas Greiss has played this year, I don't know how aggressive Seattle would be in trying to claim him either, or if that's something that you'd be, you know, petrified about happening. And so if Jonathan Bernier is your guy, just get it done. That's an element in all of this too. And it brings me to kind of what I think we want to talk about as the main topic for today, which is trading in a rebuild. What are the considerations to make? How should teams prioritize this? Because the Red Wings have a few different guys, whether that be Jonathan Bernier, whether that be Bobby Ryan, Luke Glendening, Sam Gagne, who they could very easily trade in the next 3 weeks, I think, but that would also make a lot of sense to bring back in some capacity, whether that's decided beforehand or after the fact. Guys who could help them next year in a number of different ways. So let's spend some time on that. And what do you see as kind of the pillars of how teams should approach trading in a rebuild?
Yeah, I think it's a really unique philosophy to think through. And we've kind of talked about the pillars in other areas. But when it comes to a team that's rebuilding, approaching at the deadline, I think there's kind of five things you have to pay attention to and have to be cognizant of in order to extract the best value from the trade deadline. I think step number one is you have to appropriately assess your timeline. You know, I think Steve Yzerman on day one of the job walks in and says, look, guys, this isn't going to be a short-term thing. We're looking at least 5 years here, and I'm hesitant to really give you anything firmer than that. And so as you're moving along throughout the season, you have to have a good grasp of where you are right now, where you're going to be in 3 years, and where you're going to be in 5 years. And that's going to help you then kind of get to the next section, which is identify who's on your roster right now that's going to be a part of that team moving forward in contention. And, you know, if you're sitting here and you're the Red Wings, you know, obviously that's Dylan Larkin, but you have to take stock of all the other guys. You have to have a fundamental understanding of aging curves and understand who's going to be at 90% of their peak, who's going to be at 60% of their peak, who's going to be liable to fall off a cliff here, and when should I be able to move them to try and extract maximum value from their contract. You have to, you know, then when you're making those deals, you want to be thinking about, you know, what do I need to add in order to shorten my timeline moving forward? And, you know, the goal of every trade really as a rebuilding team should be moving you closer towards identifying or acquiring elite talent. You know, we've talked about this on past episodes where I think the NHL draft right now is kind of the best market value way to land elite talent. And oftentimes that means finding yourself at the bottom of the standings for a season in order to put yourself in that position. But, you know, that means in deals, you should be looking for picks. You should be looking for prospects. You should be looking for guys that you could then subsequently flip to net you more assets. And then in the guys you're moving out, you want to be thinking about shedding contract years to maximize your cap flexibility. And so, you know, over the last few years, we've seen the Wings kind of move away from the guys having the 6-7 year deals. You know, you have the buyout of Justin Abdelkader. You have, you know, other moves along those lines to shorten the number of contracts right now, such that you only have a couple guys on the roster in 2 years that are currently signed. And then kind of the last thing that I think you have to be able to do well is you have to have an appropriate assessment of when your prospects are going to be ready for the NHL, because, you know, we oftentimes talk about having a fire sale at the deadline, but can you have a fire sale at the deadline if you have prospects that you cannot put in the NHL right now that are just simply not ready and you run the risk of stagnating their development? So ultimately, I think thinking through those five things is what's going to allow you to be kind of most successful at the trade deadline.
So there you go. Five simple things, no problem, easy as pie, right?
Yeah, I mean, every team should be able to do this. I'm sure Buffalo's got it figured out by now, right?
Of course, this is very difficult to do. And within each one of these topics are probably something we could spend an entire episode on. But I want to just hit on a few of them, 1 to 2 minutes each of them, to really give a lay of the land for where the Red Wings are at. Appropriately assess when you'll be in contention. Now, those who pay attention to the Red Wings and to Steve Yzerman know that he has avoided this like the plague. He has avoided timelines completely since taking over. He doesn't want to even get into when the Red Wings might be contenders, which from his perspective, I see the appeal of. You don't want to be held to someone like me saying, hey, you said you were going to be good by 2023 or whatever. What's going on? I mean, I think when you look at Buffalo and how long that's dragged out, one of the reasons why there seems to be so much unrest there is it's like, they went through this. They got Jack Eichel. They got him into his prime. Why is nothing happening yet? I think that would still happen if that was the case in Detroit. But not setting a timeline at least gives you a little bit of flexibility in that way of not having to be held to, I need to be good by this date. That said, you and me are not bound by that. We can kind of ballpark when we think the Red Wings probably will have a contention window opening.
Yeah, and I think if we're ballparking where the Wings are, I think I've been pretty consistent in saying I still think they're at least 3 years out from being that consistent playoff contender, unless lottery luck changes. You know, hypothetically, they win the lottery this year, they win the lottery next year, and now you're adding Shane Wright and Matty Beniers to this team, and all of a sudden you have incredible depth up front, and you have some of these D prospects moving forward, and oh, you know, Moritz Seider comes in and he has a Cale Makar type impact. Now you're talking about a team that's contending in 2 years, no doubt. Things can certainly shorten up, but I think right now you're looking in the 3 to 5 year range before you can really say that you're going to be contending again. And again, when you're making those assessments, I'd rather err on the conservative side. I'd rather err on the side of not anticipating a prospect to outperform their projection. You want to be kind of level-headed when you're going through this. So for me, you're still 3 to 5 years from being a solid, consistent playoff contender.
My dad says that. He says, you know, if you're going to be surprised, let it be a happy surprise. Don't set yourself up to be surprised in a bad way.
That's exactly how an NHL GM should be approaching. So maybe we should hire your dad to be the NHL, be the Red Wings general manager here.
I think he's had icing and offside down for, you know, 10 to 12 years now. So that's some pretty good experience for him.
Can he do goaltender interference?
As good as it's being done right now, for
all right,
sure.
All right. Fair enough.
I think that's accurate. I mean, part of the conversation that you're going to get into here is, does contention mean contending for a Stanley Cup, you're one of the 6 to 8 best teams in the NHL, or does it mean you're in the playoff hunt, maybe even a playoff team?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to think about it. I mean, if you look at what a lot of the general managers say, they say, oh, get into the playoffs, anything can happen, right? And we've certainly seen that over the years. You know, Columbus goes and sweeps Tampa. No one's expecting that to happen 2 years ago. But that being said, there is more to just getting into the playoffs. It's building a foundation to where you can consistently get into the playoffs. You don't want to be the team that's landing a 7 seed 1 year and then is out the next year. Now you're stuck in mediocrity. You want to be the team that maybe the first year you're getting in as a 7 or 8. But then the following year, you're getting in as maybe a 5 or 6. And then the year after that, you're kind of working your way towards that. So I'd say you want to find a way to be a consistent playoff contender, meaning that you are consistently making the playoffs and giving yourself the opportunity for that luck or variance to roll out in your favor.
I mean, that's where this timeline does get really hard to set, because when people ask me when I could see the Red Wings being back in the playoffs, I think my answer until this year had been 2022-23. I no longer think that's realistic. I'm going to move it back 1 year. I don't know if that's long enough, but I'm going to move it back to 2023-24. You're at that point, you will be looking at kind of established players, and obviously all this can change with any trade here, right? Like if you trade a player out of the current core, some of this changes, but you know, Larkin, Mantha, Bertuzzi, Zadina, Raymond, you're going to have solid depth players who should be established by then in Berggren, Veleno, Rasmussen. And I think at least one more drafted forward coming in, into that top nine, that I think that's a playoff caliber top nine. Assuming that, you know, the center that we're talking about as the missing piece there is drafted in the top 5 to 8 picks. I mean, it's probably fair to expect a top 6 caliber center in that range. I think 2023-24 gives you enough time to get those guys into the league, relatively established, to make the playoffs. That's like as an 8 seed, right? As a wild card. And now depending on who that is, if it's Shane Wright, maybe that goes up a little bit. I still don't think it makes you a real cup threat by 2023-24. And that's, you know, to say nothing of the defense, which I think is probably Moritz Seider, Filip Hronek, Albert Johansson. I don't know if I'm ready to call him a top four player, but I think he's on that 4-5 swing trajectory right now. I don't know what you're going to have in William Wallander or Antti Tuomisto by then. I think Troy Stetcher, if he's a longer-term piece, gives you a nice fixture there. John Merrill, if he's here to stay, gives you a nice fixture there. And you're probably going to draft at least one more defenseman in the top 8 to 10 spots as well in the next couple of years, that who could be established by then. But again, that's just to get there, to get to the, you know, maybe even you're just missing by then. But I think you've turned the corner and you're no longer sweating the tankathon in the final month of the season, so to speak. And all that, of course, depends on goaltending too. If they can't find a Jonathan Bernier level goaltender in 2023-24, then that goes out the window. I mean, it's a huge difference maker. And you see in Vancouver, I think you've seen, although Demko's been outstanding lately, but you can almost cut their season in half and say, what was the difference in the first half? They weren't getting this kind of goaltending out of Thatcher Demko. Why have they been a little better lately? Thatcher Demko's been a lot better lately. So that's a difference maker too.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, you know, if we take that as kind of the start of it, if we say 2023-24 or maybe that 24-25 season, we can move into this next phase, which is identify current players who will age out prior to that window.
Yeah. And so this kind of comes down to your understanding of aging curves. And there's a lot of back and forth, but I think most of the recent aging curve work will tell you that the peak for forwards is somewhere around age 24 and 25, similar for defensemen. Goaltenders, it's a little more variable. Some people will say maybe the peak is out to 28 to 30. And that they have shorter peaks overall. Some will say that the peak of goalies is actually much earlier than that, maybe 23, and that we just don't get goaltenders into the NHL fast enough to really see some of those peaks. So I think the goalie, again, like everything else, is more uncertain. But regardless, you should be thinking about guys who are 24 to 25 in that peak time being the guys that are going to be the ones carrying you. And then what we typically think is the average player can hold, you know, 90% of their peak all the way out to age 31, and that some of the elite players and star players tend to hold that peak out much further than that. But then after kind of age 31, 32, that's when you can start to see guys really sort of fall off a cliff, if you will. All of a sudden, they're just not the same player that they were. All of a sudden, you're seeing terrible impacts happening, and you just can't seem to figure out why. You know, Red Wings fans saw this happen a fair bit. You know, you saw this happen with Justin Abdelkader, Jonathan Erickson, and some of those being injury related. But again, guys can just fall off the cliff at that point. So, you know, in this situation, I think if you're thinking about, okay, if I'm saying 44 years from now being contention, you want to add 4 years to everyone's age right now and who's potentially aging their way out of this rebuild. And I think that kind of brings up the question of are Anthony Mantha and Tyler Bertuzzi potentially aging themselves out of this roster right now?
We could do so much time on this topic because I think, you know, Mantha is 26. Bertuzzi just turned 26. Mantha will be 27 in September. And so I think they're fair to lump into a category. But it gets interesting then of what do you do with Dylan Larkin, who's only 2 years younger? And that leads you into a lot of murky waters, I think. I mean, to me, I still look at all three of them and say they're going to be top six pieces, even by that window we just laid out. But there's a decent and possibly even more likely than not chance that Mantha and Bertuzzi will only be at that level for the first 1 to 2 years of that ensuing window. Like, if you're saying it's going to be 3 years from now that they're in the playoffs, Mantha and Bertuzzi are 29, and then you get 2 or 3 years until you're really flipping a coin every year to see how much you're going to get from them. That might even come a year sooner than that, right? Like, it happens quick after that kind of age 30, 31 season where you're getting into dicey waters. So I understand that. I also think if you move them for that reason, I think each one of them that you move, you're adding a year to the rebuild, most likely. And if that's the case, then we're going to be sitting here in 2 years. The Red Wings aren't going to be any closer than they are right now. And Dylan Larkin's going to be the same age Anthony Mantha and Tyler Bertuzzi are as we have this conversation. And are we having that conversation about him? And then you're going to, if you decide that's the right course of action, you do it again. Well, you're going to have that same conversation, you know, 1 or 2 years after that about Philip Zadina and about Philip. And it can go on and on and on like that. And I realize I'm slippery sloping this a little bit. I don't think it's ridiculous to move Mantha or Bertuzzi, but I think you got to do it really tactfully. And it has to be more about the return than just the timeline. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that's what you have to be so careful about, because there's historical precedent for rebuilding teams making these deals and being successful. And then there's historical precedent for teams making these deals and completely botching the return or botching what they did with the return. And so,
yes,
you know, we've watched Ottawa, you know, over the years sell Erik Karlsson, Mark Stone. Ottawa 3 years ago was in the conference finals. Ottawa was a period away from the Stanley Cup finals. That's where they were just 3 years ago. And they sold off Erik Karlsson. They brought in a number of picks. Yeah, they were able to get Tim Stützle out of that. They sold off Mark Stone. They didn't get enough. They got Erik Brännström and they got a 2020 second and Oscar Lindberg, but that's not enough for Mark Stone, who's arguably one of the best players, you know, in the league. They were able to sell Matt Duchene after they weirdly spent on him. But again, they have to do more and more with those deals. And right now, Ottawa doesn't look to be in a good spot. They have some pieces for sure. Brady Tkachuk looks good. You know, Drake Batherson looks good. They've got, you know, Thomas Chabot's there. Tim Stützle obviously looks good. But we're not talking about the Senators being on the way back. They're a team that still seems to be several years out. You know, and you contrast that with a team like Colorado that's able to sell high on Matt Duchene. They get a heck of a return. And what do they do with that return? They go and they draft Cale Makar. And then Cale Makar changes their rebuild. And so,
oh, that was Byram.
Byram, yes. Yep. But even Bowen Byram adding him to that piece, right, that's still a huge, huge deal. And then they go out, they sell Kyle Turris, who they get in that deal as well. And that also allows them, as a part of that three-way deal, get Sam Girard, who is now one of the best defensemen in the league, and a 2018 second-round pick out of that. And so there are teams that do it right, and you see how quickly they can turn things around, like Colorado. And then you've got teams like Ottawa that made their deals and potentially didn't get enough in one area, potentially didn't draft well with their return. You see a team like Columbus that sold Rick Nash years ago, and Columbus has not been able to dig themselves out of mediocrity. You see the Leafs, when they went on their selling spree and they sold Phil Kessel. Well, they were able to use some of the picks out of Phil Kessel to turn that into Freddie Anderson, who was good for a period of time up until this year. But you know, you have to pay attention to the teams that know what they're doing and know how to tear it down, because just selling them off to sell them off is going to put you exactly where you said, Max. It's going to put you right here 3 years from now. You're in no better spot. So you have to really smartly approach this, I think, and kind of follow the path of do not settle for taking too little and make sure you know what you're doing with these returns.
And the tightrope you walk is that even if the GM goes into this saying, okay, I want to do this, you know, thoughtfully and well, Joe Sakic would not have told you on the day of the Matt Duchene trade that it was going to result in an entire left side top four decor. You know what I mean? Like Bowen Byram and Sam Girard of the future there, right? Like that's, no one could have told you that. Doesn't mean that the upside, you know, wasn't there when you have a pick like that, but it was also totally plausible at that time that Ottawa stayed really good and they ended up in the, you know, that pick ended up in the 18 to 23 range or something like that. And that, you know, that Sam Girard busted, you know, like that could have happened too, based on the Kyle Turris flip. So it is a dicey proposition. It's a tightrope you have to walk. And that's why I think when people call for a move like that, you have to do it really carefully. And there are situations where I think it makes sense, but I think to me, it's more about the situation of the trade than it is the situation of the player.
Yeah.
And that gets into, you know, a point three, which is obtain picks and prospects geared toward landing elite talent. The, you know, eternal, much easier said than done, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's just go out and get someone to give you a couple of first round picks, you know,
at the elite talent store.
Yeah.
It's right next to Checkers.
That's exactly right. I mean, just go out, have them give you a couple of first round picks, get them to, you know, under the table handshake deal where they'll go and tank their next season. And that way you've got three lottery picks and everything works great, right? I mean, that's totally the way this is going to work. But in reality, it's not. And that's why it's so important to make sure that you're selling these players. If you're going to make the deal, you're not settling for too little. And I think that's the key here is find someone who is willing to pay the price that you'd like, because if they don't and you settle for too little, you've now set yourself back not just 1 year, but likely a couple of years. And so I think that's the key here is don't go out and make, you know, the kind of deal that doesn't bring you enough. You need to go out and make the smart deals for these players and know what you're doing with the returns.
And sometimes that means not going out and shopping around at all. It's waiting for that to present itself to you. Because if I'm a GM, what am I looking for? I'm looking for who's calling me, asking about one of his really good players. And I'm wondering, okay, I can get this guy off him, right? I don't have to give up something I'm all that attached to here, right? So sometimes it means sitting back and waiting. It doesn't mean you're not doing your job. The GM's got to call around and talk all the time. But, you know, there's probably a way to play that's not so aggressively like, hey, you know, what will you give me for this guy? What will you give me for Mantha? Like that, I don't know that that leads you to where you want to be.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think some of these deals, I think when we end up hearing a little bit more about how they came to fruition, it's spur of the moment. Someone called and just said, hey, what, you know, are you guys willing to move this guy? And all of a sudden, you know, bam, a deal's on the table and that's how things can work. And so, you know, super, super important to make sure you know what you're doing here.
All right, moving into point four. This is one that I think the Red Wings may be literally the best position team in the league already, which is shed contract years where possible to maximize flexibility. Anthony Mantha and Dylan Larkin are the only guys signed beyond next season.
Yeah, this is by far, if you're grading the Red Wings rebuild, they get an A++ in this section of maintaining cap flexibility. And this is imperative because like you and I have just talked about for the last several minutes, we have a guess when we think the Wings are going to be good again. We have a guess when we think they're going to be in playoff contention. But if you go out and you hamstring yourself on that guess and something goes the wrong way, you're stuck. You have gone out and you have shot your rebuild in the foot. And now you're sitting in a position where you're in purgatory for several more years. And I mean, there's plenty of examples of this. I mean, it's Edmonton going and dealing Taylor Hall for Adam Larson because they don't need that offense at that time and they want some defense. And Adam Larson's not Taylor Hall. It's not that move. You go out, you make that deal, you end up in a big, bad spot. They go out, they trade Jeff Petrie, who is an outstanding defenseman for Montreal. Now, Edmonton needs defense. And so it's making those right moves. It's maintaining that flexibility. It's making sure that you've got the years and space available such that at the right moment, when everything comes together, you can pounce. This is what I've been talking about with, you know, the Carolina Hurricanes in 2018. You land Andrei Svechnikov second overall, and all of a sudden you trade Elias Lindholm and Noah Hanifin for Dougie Hamilton. You trade Jeff Skinner to clear out that contract. You're able to make big free agent signings, but they did it by keeping everything short, by maintaining that roster flexibility, and by year after year. Each year prior to that 2018 draft, they were selling, and they were selling for picks, they were selling for prospects, shedding those contracts, shedding the term, making sure that at the right moment when everything came together, they could jump on it. And so Wings have done an outstanding job of that. And it's not really a concern for them moving forward, but they have to continue to be diligent about this.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, the last step is one that I think you would get a mixed response on how the Red Wings are doing. And that's appropriately scoped when current prospects are ready to transition to the NHL. You know, this is one that I have a real big disclaimer above anything I'm going to say, because in 3 years on this beat, I've learned that I don't actually know this. I probably came in thinking that I could identify it. I wrote at 2019 training camp that Joe Valeno was doing everything he seemed to need to do to take a run at the roster. Even if I didn't think he would make it, I thought he was showing everything that you'd have wanted to see from him. He doesn't even come close to making the team, and then he has like a good, not unbelievable season in the AHL. So clearly, I was seeing something that wasn't reflective of what you actually need to be seeing to know when someone is ready to transition to the NHL. I was too early on thinking Zadina was going to be ready for the NHL. It's clearly something that's really hard to assess. And so I almost go into this thinking, man, my information gap is such that I can tell you what I think. I'm not sure that I could tell you when someone is ready for the NHL.
Welcome to the club. I don't think anyone can tell you, right? I think it's all a guess. You know, anyone who tells you that they know exactly when a player is ready to hit the NHL is, I mean, I have a bridge to sell you, because it's difficult. There is no guarantee anywhere for when any of these guys are going to be ready. There's work being done to assess this. I think that's the fun part, is there's not really been a lot of analytic work done in development tracks and development pipelines. I think if you're interested, check out Connor Jung's, J-U-N-G, his prospect work. His model, the Apple model, is kind of projecting kind of prospect development and pipelines and almost assessing the probability of when a player would go to the NHL based on historical players that have come before them. I think that's a really neat way to do it. He and I are actually going to take a look at which teams tend to overperform and underperform relative to the expected development pipelines to try and put some actual development work out there. But the fact of the matter is, no one can really tell you what the development's going to look like and when a player is really ready. And you don't know until you go and you drop them in the NHL and you see what happens. And so that's why, even though, you know, I'll make fun of teams for saying I want someone to dominate at a lower league before they go to the next league, it's because that they at least can feel sure or better about their decision to move them up. To me, that's a wasted year, but in reality, it's a GM telling you, I now feel sure about moving this guy up. That's how Gustav Nyquist comes in and basically goes point per game in the 2013-2014 season. Is, you know, at that point, he is raring to go, and he comes in, he scores 30 goals in 57 games and just completely turns the league upside down. So it's then you feel good about it. Then you feel good about your assessment, but you don't know would it have been better earlier. So at the end of the day, this is, I think, the hardest step. Because you can't just sell the farm. You can't just sell every player on your team.
Wait. This is harder than going to get the elite talent?
This is harder than going to get the elite talent, I think.
I don't know about that. Who's got the elite talent?
I think it's in the elite talent store, Max, and you just need to know how to get there. But no, in reality, I think if you continue to position yourself at the bottom of the draft, you are likely at some point to get lucky with your pick and get there. This, though, is... how do I make sure I don't botch the development timeline of a player? That's the tough part. And that's because there is nothing that tells you when a guy is ready to go or not. And we've seen this over the last decade as, you know, watching this team, whether it was Thomas Yurko, a guy who's supremely talented, but then don't know what to do. It's Timu Polkinen scoring literally a goal per game in the AHL, but then coming up and not being able to do anything at the NHL level. And it's, what was he missing? You know, we've seen this year after year with some of these different guys that it is such a challenge to understand how to do. And this is why you can't just go out and sell every player on your roster. And this is why you still every year are out there shopping for veterans. It's because this is, to me, the hardest aspect of moving your team forward, is knowing when these guys are ready.
All right. So let's take those concepts and let's turn it into something practical. We may leave that last one out of the equation a little bit here for a minute, that scoping current prospects transition time. I'll tee you up to talk about one of your real sources of expertise among the many that you have and you bring to the show. Let's talk about the Carolina Hurricanes rebuild, because they are a team that I think has pulled off a rebuild in a in pretty much the way that you want to see. If you're entering a rebuild, you want it to probably end up somewhat like the Hurricanes ended up. And so I don't want to hear the whole story of the Carolina Hurricanes rebuild. I just want to hear how they managed the trade deadline. What did they do well as it pertained to that? And is there anything the Red Wings can take from it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I alluded to this earlier. If you look at their three deadlines prior to the 2018 draft, 15, 16, and 17, I think the number one thing that they did well was they understood the guys that had high value to other teams. And then they went out and made good deals that actually really kind of netted above market value returns. And so, you know, at 2015, it's moving Andre Sekera for a conditional first that, again, in this one, you got a first out of it. It didn't end up being a high-impact player for them. It was Julien Gauthier, who was then dealt to the Rangers for Joey Keane last year. And they're able to go out and move Yuri Tulusti for a 2016 third. So they're bringing in a couple picks. 2016, they've got a couple of guys to shop. And this is the one that I think is the big parallel for Wings fans. The guy they deal in 2016 is Eric Staal. He was the face of the franchise. He was the captain. He was the guy that, you know, took them on so many playoff runs as their best playoff performer. You know, the 09 run for the Hurricanes to the conference finals. He scored some memorable goals there. But you go and you deal them, and they bring back a 2016 second that ends up being a part of the deal that brings Teuvo Teravainen to the Hurricanes. And so they're using those assets and flipping them around. They get another second out of that as well. They move Christopher Stieg. They move John Michael Lyles. Again, bringing in a couple more picks with those deals. And then in 2017, they bring in Victor Stahlberg for a third that they use to get goaltending help with Scott Darling that ultimately didn't work out. They move Ron Hainsey, 38-year-old Ron Hainsey, for a 2017 second that ended up being dealt to Vegas for Trevor Van Riemsdyk. And so this is how they were able to bring pieces of their team in. And so from those three rebuilds, from those three deadlines, they moved a lot of money out, a lot of term out, brought five picks in, and then were able to use those picks to bring in Teuvo Teravainen and Trevor Van Riemsdyk, two guys who are part of their playoff roster. And Teravainen's now one of the best players in the NHL. So they were able to very smartly value which guys were likely to net the biggest returns, go out, make those deals, and get kind of the at least market value, if not more, for each of them.
Now, help me out here. My memory's fuzzy on the Bickle and Teravainen thing. Did that have anything to do with Bickle's money? Like, was that a cap situation at all?
Yeah, that was Chicago being squeezed with the cap. And so, again, yeah. Carolina's like, here, I'll give you a couple of picks. So Carolina makes some deals, and they say, okay, we'll take Brian Bickle, but you got to throw in Teravainen with him as well. Yeah. And in return, we'll give you picks. So that'll help us take some of that money away. But again, they position themselves as a team with cap flexibility to be able to make a deal like that.
So the reason I like this example is because it's something the Red Wings could do too. I mean, they could say to a team, hey, you got to move money out. That's fine. We got this. We'll even give you something. You know, it doesn't have to just be a straight handoff for future considerations like the Mark Staal thing is, but you're going to have to give us a good young player too, right? Like that's something Steve Yzerman could say. Another thing Steve Yzerman could do is what you mentioned with Ron Hainsey dealing with Vegas for Trevor Van Riemsdyk, who got Trevor Van Riemsdyk via the expansion draft, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's something that, you know, as Seattle comes into, having all these players that it's just going to be picking up, you know, they're not going to be able to play all of them. You don't have a 31-man roster, 30-man roster, I guess, because Vegas is exempt from this. They can trade those for extra picks. And in fact, I would wager they're going to be looking to do that on some guys. So that's another example of you build up this stockpile and it allows you to then deal with a team like Seattle, who's going to be in a position to help you out too. They might prefer picks in some cases to some of these young players.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And so that going back to one of the principles being maintaining that cap flexibility, Carolina being able to practice that allowed them to make a deal that really reshaped their future and put them in position to make, make kind of the noise moving forward once they were able to land Svechnikov. And Detroit's very well positioned to do that too. I mean, there's a number of teams between this year, next year, and in years coming where they're going to be struggling to land or to be able to clear cap space. I mean, Vegas is still a team that stands out to me. Hardly any money comes off the books this year. Thomas Nosek's going to be a free agent, Alec Martinez, Dylan Colan, but that's it. They've still got $12 million tied up in goaltending for next year. I mean, Can you get Vegas to give you Marc-Andre Fleury plus one of their higher-end prospects or something along those lines?
I don't know if
they're
trading Fleury at this point with the way he's
playing. The way he's played this year, sure. But you can potentially see he's a guy that at his age, I'm going to suspect is going to drop off a cliff or have some wild variants happening because he wasn't good last year. Probably not going to deal him this year, but he's still under contract again next year. And so if you're Vegas, are you willing to move him out and his $7 million knowing you don't have to retain anything? And if you're Detroit, can you land some of their, picks or prospects or guys that they've got available for him? So, Vegas is just one example, but the fact of the matter is you want to be positioning yourself to be able to do this kind of deal. You saw it a little bit with Mark Stahl, although the return was a second. I think you can do this in ways that also bring you good young roster players.
Yeah. All right. Obviously the cap side of that is kind of a secondary focus that we could talk about on the show to kind of some of those mid-tier trades that they can pull off with their pending UFAs. It's the kind of thing that's going to net you a mid-round pick or maybe kind of a B prospect for guys that you take a flyer on. But like you said, there's real value to stockpiling those picks and just then you can do whatever you want with them. You can make the pick, you can trade the pick, you can do whatever you want. It gives you darts, it gives you ammo for trades. Teams always want draft picks. So even if you yourself are not going to be the one to make them, it gives you ammo to go out and take a run at somebody else. So it's never bad to have a ton of draft picks. Never.
Yeah, and that's what Carolina's done such a good job at over the last few years is they don't make all their picks. They were able to use a couple picks to turn it into Teuvo Teravainen and take on the salary of Brian Bickell. They were able to use picks to get Trevor Van Riemsdyk. They've been able to flip picks up and down drafts the last few years. So they're definitely a team that's done a really nice job in moving those picks around. And so, you're Detroit right now. You've got 3 second-round picks already. Potentially you're able to land a couple more picks, and then you want to be able to utilize them. You don't have to make every pick, although in Detroit's case, it's not a bad idea to make a lot of picks. But if there's teams that are lacking a lot of picks right now, which there are plenty of teams that have dealt far too many picks away, Edmonton being one of them, there's the potential to sell those picks back or give picks back to those teams in exchange for more picks, more prospects, something along those lines. So at the end, you want to be the one holding all the cards and just knowing when to play them.
The path to that pick stockpiling probably comes through adding mid-rounders for guys like Mark Stahl, Luke Glendening, Bobby Ryan, Sam Gagner. Those who've been listening and reading know that. Let's spend 5 to 10 minutes here on kind of what I guess we would term the shakeup potential trades. And I know I do this to you sometimes. I kind of put you on the hot seat. So I will formally ask you, are you ready to go on the hot seat here as I ask you these questions?
I am absolutely ready. Let's do it.
All right. So, Anthony Mantha, what would it take for you to move Anthony Mantha? How does all this that we've learned about over the course of this episode apply to someone like an Anthony Mantha? And let's throw Tyler Bertuzzi in there too, or do you want to do him separate?
Yeah, we should talk about them both together. Bertuzzi will be a little bit of a unique case given that he just hasn't played really this year.
He's injured, yes.
And we have no idea what his timetable is like. He may not even be healthy enough to be dealt at the trade deadline in 20 days, so we don't know that. But, the Mantha deal is one you have to entertain, right? We just said if we follow our principles that we laid out, and we say 4 years from now is when we think Detroit would be consistently contending, Anthony Mantha's 30. I just said that forwards can sometimes fall off the cliff around 31 or so. Mantha, I think, is good enough to sustain his play maybe to 33, 34. But are you better off taking value for him right now? And so there's a number of deals out there that I think are possible surrounding Anthony Mantha. I think Craig Custance in his article, someone had pitched a deal of a first-round pick, third-round pick, and Jake Bean from Carolina to Detroit in exchange for Anthony Mantha. And Jake Bean's a guy that Carolina could potentially lose in the expansion draft. And we know Carolina's first this year is probably going to be in the high 20s. And so if you're thinking in that regard, that's a deal that I think you absolutely make. Because if you're Detroit, you're kind of acknowledging that your timeline's a little far out right now. And for a 26-year-old Anthony Mantha, you might as well take picks and prospects, Jake Bean being 22, guys who are going to maybe better fit your timeline moving forward.
So is the idea that the Canes would protect Slavin and Pesce, obviously, and then Brady Shea over Jake Bean? Or because Dougie Hamilton's an unrestricted free agent. They don't have to protect him.
They don't have to in the sense that if you let him be unsigned, right, he's immediately a free agent the following day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's been some stories in Carolina. I think it'll be interesting to see if they try and get a deal done with him ahead of the time, because I've, based on the stories that I've read, it does seem like they're still a little bit apart. And so does Carolina risk letting Dougie Hamilton hit unrestricted free agency? Do they protect him versus losing Jake Bean? I don't know what they're going to do. You know, everyone should check out, you know, Sarah Sivian's article. She hasn't done it since the end of 2020, but in that scenario, she had them extending Dougie prior to the expansion draft in order to protect him, and as such, losing Jake Bean afterwards. I don't think they protect Brady Shea over Jake Bean, especially with the way Jake Bean's playing right now, 10 points, 20 games.
And with Shea's contract, yeah, pretty high.
Yeah. Right. But it will be, that's the number one question, I think, is do they get a deal done with Dougie Hamilton before the expansion draft, or do they let him hit unrestricted free agency?
I mean, Bean is a 22 going on 23, 6'1" left shot D. He's a former 13th overall pick in the 2016 draft. And while he's kind of just getting his toe, I guess he's kind of all in now. He's played 20 games in the NHL this year. But in previous seasons, you know, he played two NHL games in 2018-19. He played zero in 2019-20. But in the AHL, he's been very good. I mean, he was at 0.8 points per game as a second-year defenseman in the AHL last season. That's at age 21. That's really impressive. I mean, it's the kind of thing that if you add that to a late first-round pick, and I think Bean would be the centerpiece of a trade like that, I actually think that makes a lot of sense. I think it's the kind of thing you could reasonably argue for. I'm a little skeptical that Carolina would, decide that they're not going to just make it work and protect Bean and then, you know, take the Dougie conversation to the wire. But if that's the way it plays out and they decide, hey, this is a guy that we're going to lose here one way or the other, let's make a move, then I think it's the kind of thing, that's the kind of deal you consider moving Amantha or Bertuzzi for, because you can immediately see what it's getting you. You're not playing this game on who's going to be there at 24, 25. You can make a straight up assessment. This is a guy who looks like a top four defenseman in Jake Bean.
Yeah. And I mean, at the rate he's scoring at right now, that's top pair scoring rate at 0.5 points per game. And, you know, using Connor Jung's model that I just alluded to, you know, he's got him projected to land somewhere between a top four and a top pair defenseman. Left shot.
I mean, he's scoring almost as much as Filip Hronek,
right,
at the same age.
And it's not secondary assists. It's actual points. So, you know, I think if you're looking at Detroit's roster and their pipeline, the right side seems to be pretty solid. It's the left side that needs some addition. And so if you have the ability to not only get a first-round pick, but to get a guy that could be your top pair left defenseman, or at bare minimum, your second pair left defenseman, and then you can figure out what you want to do with Albert Johansson, I think that's a hugely attractive deal. So to me,
especially
that deal,
when it comes with a pick,
right? When it comes with a first round pick, and in that scenario, also a third round pick. So you now have four third round picks, and that's where you can start getting into the shopping scenarios there. So I think that's a very attractive deal on the surface, and I think there's potential to make a deal like that with a lot of other teams.
Yeah. So that's in Craig Custance's Who Says No article. I thought it was outstanding the other day. And the executive said he thinks it makes sense for both teams. So I think that is something that, you know, when you see that, it's pretty interesting. Is there, you mentioned a deal to me the other day when we were texting about, you know, this topic and what would it realistically, like, what would you really move Mantha for, that I thought was very interesting. And it's based on a similar premise about the expansion draft.
Yeah, it's the Colorado Avalanche, and they're a team that's, again, going to have some expansion draft decisions. You know, the more I think about what they'll do, if you look at their defense, they're going to have to protect Eric Johnson as of now because he has a no-move clause. And then behind Eric Johnson, guys that would need to be protected are Sam Girard, Kiel McCarr, and Devin Taves. And so those three are obviously all outstanding defensemen. All three warrant protection. You know, potentially the most likely scenario for the Avs is you get Eric Johnson to waive his no move clause under the expectation that Seattle would be unlikely to take him. And potentially then you can navigate by protecting Girard, Taves, and protecting McCarr at that point. However, you know, if Colorado is in the mood to explore dealing from depth, because in addition to those four guys I've mentioned, they obviously have Bowen Byram, they have Connor Timmins,
Ryan Graves.
I mean, they have a heck of a defensive group. Are they willing to explore a deal in which they're willing to move one of those younger guys, whether it's a Bowen Byram, a Sam Girard, or a Connor Timmins? I think Timmins is maybe a little behind Byram, and I think Byram's maybe a little behind Girard. But if you can center a deal around one of those excellent Avs defensemen.
Well, Byram's exempt. Byram is exempt from
expansion. Yeah, no, I just mean like, I'm just talking trade purpose in general. If you can center a deal around one of those three guys, around Mantha and around one of those three defensemen, whether it's Girard, who's 22, and right now, if you go to Evolving Hockey and hit sort by goals above replacement and filter to defenseman, Girard's number one in the league in goals above replacement, or Connor Timmins, who is an excellent prospect, or Bowen Byram, who, you know, Red Wings fans certainly remember as an outstanding defenseman from the WHL, who's, again, had a good start to the season here. If you're able to center a deal around one of those three guys with Mantha, that's another possibility to think about, particularly if there is any rumblings that Eric Johnson's unwilling to waive his no move clause, which I don't know if that'll be the case, but either way, I think you still have an opportunity to make a deal here.
Certainly the kind of thing to monitor. I mean, these are the things that are going to come up a lot around the expansion draft, is teams that are squeezed at a certain position. Now, Colorado, here's what I would wonder. Does Colorado just protect four? Because I think they could probably get away with just protecting four forwards in McKinnon, Rantanen, Landeskog, Kadri.
Yeah, if you do that, I mean, at that point, you know, you're risking Brandon Saad, who is 28. Yep. And Brandon Saad, you know, I actually had an Avs fan say this to me the other day, that when they added Brandon Saad, they thought he was a luxury. But now you're realizing that it's almost a necessity, that he has helped really elevate their play this season as well. And I mean, we're talking about the Avs right now. They're out shooting opponents.
He's pending UFA, so they could do that. They could expose.
So they could do the same thing, you know, same concept as Dougie Hamilton. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting call. You could. I'd be surprised, because there's a lot of really good forwards in Colorado as well.
Yeah, you'd be exposing Burakovsky, Compher, Donskoy, all players who I think Seattle would be reasonably happy to have on their inaugural
so
team.
I think it's likely that they get Eric Johnson the wave in that scenario. But I just think regardless, it's the same concept as dealing for Jake Bean. You're dealing with a team that has a plethora of players that are outstanding. Jake Bean, the only reason he's not in the NHL already is he's behind that excellent Carolina defensive group and has struggled to crack that lineup. Similar concept with Connor Timmins here. And, you know, so potentially you're able to make a deal with Colorado in that kind of vein.
All right. I think that I could definitely see the logic there. I mean, you know, the one that I have asked you about just between the two of us in the past is, if I'm making a mover on this, I want a young player who I can reasonably project. I don't want to be playing the guessing game in the draft unless it's inside the top probably 10 to 15, because then you kind of know what kind of prospect you're going to get. And Mantha's term, I think, opens you up to be able to make that case to a team that, you know, I want your top prospect. I don't just want a draft pick. And then the one I've wondered about is a team like Minnesota that's gotten off to a start at a really nice first half to the season here. They're absolutely in contention for the West Division. Certainly look like they're going to be a threat to be in the playoffs. And, you know, you never know. They might finish the regular season right in line with a Colorado or a Vegas. And I look at Matt Boldy at Boston College, who's a guy that, you know, I saw in the lead up to the 2019 NHL draft. He was a good player, and I think, you know, he's really continued to grow at Boston College. And I wonder, would you trade Anthony Mantha for Matt Boldy straight up? Would Minnesota do that? I don't know.
I think Minnesota, if they're looking at their team right now, and you're talking about a potentially youngish group, they may not. However, you know, you never know. I mean, they've got a lot of depth at forward now. I mean, obviously hoping that Marco Rossi recovers from his COVID, you know, his COVID infection to maybe back to his heights. But Adam Beckman's been an outstanding player, you know, as in his development. Joel Eriksson Ek is developing at an outstanding rate. Obviously, we can't do this without talking about Kaprizov and him just looking like Datsyuk out there at times. So maybe Minnesota says no, but at the same time, you can say, look, with the way we're playing right now, we might as well take advantage of our kind of aging defensive group to a certain extent and say, yeah, let's go for it. Let's make a deal. Matt, you know, send Anthony Mantha over because they can always use some more scoring, as well as being a defensively responsible defense or forward, and then say, yeah, let's trade Matt Boldy. So I think that would be a very interesting deal for the Wings to make. Now, Matt Boldy's a winger, right? So
yep.
The Wings have a lot of wingers already. Doesn't necessarily help you down the center spot, but Boldy also has an outstanding goal scoring capacity. And, you know, you just imagine him playing on a line with, you know, some of the playmakers that the Wings have, and that'd be a lot of fun to watch.
Well, the reason I think it makes sense, you know, in principle, and I don't, you know, I'm not starting a rumor here. It's just one that as I've thought of, what would it really take? Because people have asked about Mantha for so long now this season that it's made me kind of think about what would it really take to make sense for the Red Wings? And what's a team that could really offer that and could be in position to do it? The reason I think it makes sense for the Wild is, like you said, they've got a little bit of an aging defense core. And while I really like Boldy as a prospect, I don't know that you could say he has higher upside than Mantha, like not drastically. I mean, you can argue that he's got more runway to really reach that upside. But at the end of the day, Mantha's a player who we've seen what he can be. Last season, he was on pace to be a 70-point winger. He's a big, physically imposing winger who can score goals, who can make plays, and who can give you something at every part of the ice. Boldy's not quite as big as Mantha, but it's kind of a similar deal there. Like, he's a big winger who can be a power forward. He can score goals. And, you know, I think he plays significant penalty kill for Boston College, if I'm right about that.
I don't know off the top of my head.
I think I saw that he has like 3 shorthanded goals or something this season. I'll look it up as you talk at the next break here. But that's why I think Minnesota would do well to continue it, because you really just kind of press the fast forward button on Boldy and you get that guy now when you're going into the playoffs rather than having to wait for him to develop and mature. The reason I think that it could make some sense for the Red Wings is that you're kind of hitting the rewind button and you're getting Mantha's age kind of reset. And you don't know if you're going to get a player as good as Mantha. Maybe you get a little bit on the up end of maybe you get a guy who's that and he's that younger and all that. But really what you're doing is, this is a move that I think you could argue is, this is a fair value prospect-wise and it fits your timeline and you just get a little younger. It's why I think it could make sense, but I don't know. And this is not source. This is not intel. It's just as I've thought about, you know, people have asked what would you do for Mantha? This is one that's popped into my head, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Boldy, and along the same lines, if you can sweet talk Montreal into Cole Caulfield, I think either one of them makes a heck of a lot of sense in this regard. I think Montreal is very similar to Minnesota in that respect, and there's always an association with Montreal and Mantha, just given the French-Canadian connection. So, yeah, I mean, that kind of player for really good prospect makes a lot of sense for the Wings, because in addition to getting a guy who you are kind of expecting to be a good player, you're resetting that timeline by finding a guy who is now going to maybe be aging into his prime by the time you think you're going to be good. So you're not necessarily really losing years at all on your rebuild.
All right, so Matt Boldy does not have 3 shorthanded goals. I was thinking of a different Boston College player, Mark McLaughlin. He does have 1. So I think that means he kills penalties, unless that was kind of a freak situation where he just got tossed out for the last 12 seconds and made the most of it. I don't know. I haven't watched Boston College very much. I'm looking forward to during the tournament this week.
Yeah, I haven't really watched Boston College at all because I've been mainly watching Boston University by virtue of having half my family go to Boston University and half the Red Wings prospects are at Boston University. So,
well, nevertheless, I just think it's an interesting concept. And I think there's deals like that to be done. You mentioned Cole Caulfield. I actually, you know, like, I don't know that Cole Caulfield's going to win the Hobie Baker, so that's probably, you know, a sign that he's kind of put more on the board in college in 2 years than Matt Boldy has. I'm not totally sure that I think Cole Caulfield's projection is like, you know, I mean, the complete upside of Cole Caulfield is clear. It's like, you know, Alex DeBrincat all over again. I'm not sure that I would value Caulfield that much higher than Matt Boldy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still...
They
I'll
went close
this.
Together in the draft.
They did.
Like, pretty close.
Only, yeah. I think, 5 picks apart, if I remember correctly. With Boldy actually going before Caulfield. I think Boldy went 10, if I remember correctly. And Caulfield... No, Boldy went 12 and Caulfield went 15, if I remember correctly. So, you know, they're not that far apart. I think the biggest difference is there's always going to be question marks about Caulfield's skating and size. Mm-hmm. You know, is he big enough? Is he the same skater as DeBrincat? I don't think so. But... you just continue to watch him dominate the levels that he's at from a goal scoring standpoint. I mean, he absolutely is going to run away with the Hobie Baker. Like, this is all just a show. Cole Caulfield is going to win the Hobie Baker, and he's just been absolutely dominant. So it's interesting. It's certainly interesting. For some reason, you know, I still want to bet on Matt Boldy a little bit more than Caulfield, but it has nothing to do with anything logical and everything to do with, is Caulfield going to be able to continue doing this?
Yeah, it's like a toolkit translation thing.
Right. That's exactly it. Like, is he going to be able to continue to do this at the next level? And I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Yeah. But I just think, you know, that's the kind of thing I would take the name that I can let my scouting staff right now tell me as I'm making the deal. What do you think of this? What do you think of this guy? What do you think of this value with a named player? Then I would, you know, the nebulous, oh, that's a first round pick that could land anywhere from, you know, realistically, if it's a contender doing that, you know, 20 to 32. And I just would much prefer that. And, you know, Boldy obviously was drafted at 12 and Caulfield was drafted at 15. So obviously that's a little bit better than you're expecting to get between 20 and 32. But I don't know. I'm rambling at this point, but I just thought that was kind of a worthwhile dive there. Obviously there's some wild cards too that I think we could probably get into. I mean, is it fair to say that the range you would want for Bertuzzi is pretty much the same as you would for Mantha? It's different situations because Mantha's got the term, but Bertuzzi's got his own advantage that he's an RFA and you can negotiate your own contract with him.
Yeah, I think you have that advantage. I think it's fair to ask for a similar return. I don't think you get a similar return because I think Mantha at least has pedigree in the sense that he's done this multiple seasons. Has the pedigree of what he did, you know, as a prospect, and has the pedigree of what he did when he scored a goal per game as a draft pick, you know, in his pre-draft year. Tyler Bertuzzi doesn't necessarily have all of those. However, he has scrapped and earned his way to being a top line forward in the NHL and has continued to prove absolutely everybody wrong. But I don't think he has enough of a track record to where a team is going to want to pay the same price that you are asking for when it comes to Anthony Mantha.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good stopping point there then. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we let everybody go? The Red Wings have a couple of games this week at Nashville, a team that all of a sudden they're kind of within striking range of in the Central Division.
It's wild. I mean, there was because Chicago's goaltending has fallen back to earth. That fourth spot really comes up for grabs here, whether it's Columbus, Nashville, Dallas, or Detroit. So we'll see. There is going to be no playoff chase. I'm going to just say that. But
I was going to say, you're putting them in the playoff chase.
No.
They're
absolutely
four
not.
Points back of Nashville with the same number of games played, 9 points back of Chicago and Columbus with the same number of games. But I don't think they're in the playoff hunt, but they are. They're in the hunt for seventh. I mean, maybe sixth. I don't know. It depends what happens with Dallas in that four game differential.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think at the end of the day, especially if Jonathan Bernier is out for a period of time, you will see everything come crashing down.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's an apt. You know, we said the stat of how many games the Red Wings have won, three without Jonathan Bernier at least playing in the game. Let's see what happens down the stretch here if he has to miss more than just a couple games. That is the expectation. He's going to miss the Nashville series. I don't know if people needed to hear that. I think it probably went without saying, but that is the expectation. So we'll see how that goes for the Red Wings this week. And of course, March Madness is here, and the Athletics College Basketball crew brings you The Ding U, presented by BetMGM. We'll cover all the action, both on the court and at the sportsbook, grabbing insight from the Athletics' top college basketball writers and picking the brain of BetMGM's top bookmakers. The next show is Tuesday at 12 p.m. Central on the Daily Dings feed and streaming on the Athletics' YouTube channel. See you there.